After the results of this week's election became final, many people say they felt disoriented and were having difficulty understanding the world that they now live in. One place where we've seen a true connection between people, art, and politics this year is the theater. Just this week, I spoke to Lynn Nottage, Kate Wariski, and Chris Davis about their play Sweat, and with Richard Nelson about his theatrical trilogy, The Gabriels. If you haven't heard these interviews, make sure you go back and listen. And for this week's bonus weekend podcast, we've decided to look back at some other notable plays that have taken on American political life. Last March, after Richard Nelson had premiered the first play in his Gabriels trilogy, he joined me to talk about it. In 2010, Alex Timbers discussed his hit rock musical, Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. And in 2007, I spoke with Frank Langella about his portrayal of Richard Nixon on Broadway in the play Frost Nixon. Enjoy. If you're tired of the current political carnival and would like to contemplate the state of the country in good company, you might want to head down to the Public Theater and sit near the kitchen of the extended Gabriel family as they prepare dinner and talk. It's the basis of Richard Nelson's very naturalistic new play, Hungry, the first in a planned cycle of three plays entitled The Gabriels, Election Year in the Life of One Family. It's at the Public Theater until April 3rd, and I'm very pleased to welcome to our show playwright Richard Nelson and actors Marianne Plunkett and J.O. Sanders. Welcome back, all of you.
Thank you.
Richard, are you the inventor of the genre of the political play cycle executed in real time?
I may be. I don't know of any other examples of this that preceded the Apples.
What were you hoping to do when you came up with the idea?
Well, one
the Apples being the previous cycle.
Exactly. Mostly, I was interested in trying to find a common ground with the audience. The idea that we were going to do the play on the same day that the audience was experiencing was something there that allowed the audience to come in with on the same ground, same level as we were doing the show.
But then history intrudes, so you have to change it all the time?
No, well, then it becomes a history play. when you're in previews, it's a play in the future, then for one day it's in real time, and then it's a history play.
And this takes place on March 4th, so now it's a history play.
Correct.
You did it with the Apple family during Obama's reelection campaign, and now with the Gabriels. What's your take on the sheer theatricality of the real-life primary battles that are going on?
Well, you know, that's really hard to say. It's so complicated and disheartening, obviously. In terms of the Gabriels, in terms of my characters, they're just it's a family. It's a family like yours or mine, and they sit around making a meal and dealing with their own life, and the way in which the politics happens is just interwoven within their life.
Marianne, why are they gathered together on March 4th, 2016?
We have spread my late husband's ashes in the Hudson River that morning. So that's where we're all gathered for that.
And how would you describe this family socioeconomically?
I think they're people who survive in Rhinebeck. They're not the upper class. They're workers. Jay's character creates furniture and is a piano teacher. And I'm a doctor, but I gave up my practice to take care of my husband as he was ill.
This is in Rhinebeck, New York.
Rhinebeck, New York.
And those towns, Rhinebeck, like any number of others, Rhinebeck, which is now being called Brooklyn North, as a number of other towns up there are, Kingston, Hudson, they have two kinds of residents. They have the locals who are there all the time, and then they have the people who come up for weekends. The locals kind of serve the weekenders.
Mm-hmm.
Jay?
Yes.
One of the interesting things about this play is in most similar situations. So we wind up with a family at real odds with each other. There's always somebody who is the redneck uncle, and that. But that's not the case here.
Well, it's not factional. Not factional. We're not set against each other. We're all together trying to make a life, which is something that I think everybody can identify with. What we're really dealing with is the difficulty of the country to come together, to be able to listen to each other and make sense of our present circumstances, and in doing that, live within an economy that allows us to grow and thrive.
But even when people kind of agree with each other, they have differences, and that's part of the fun of this conversation.
Everyone has musings. Everyone has wonderings. And one of the rules that we have is that we continue to ask questions, not make statements. And I think people recognize that their questions in life are being answered, their questions in politics. So we may all come in with basically the same viewpoint. We're a Northeastern liberal democratic family, but we still all have questions about the people who are supposedly representing us. So if that person's the best we've got, why did they do this? Or weren't they going to do that? And then they said this, but they did, you know.
So is this a matter of all politics being local, or in this case, personal as well?
I would say politics being personal, but politics being eternal.
Did the Gabriels feel that they've been left behind as their town has gotten more glamorous?
I would say yes. I would say that you come from a depressed area that's gone through many ups and downs, but it's a classic American town. Certainly relates all the way back to the colonial period, clearly, and very heavily identified with Franklin Roosevelt and all. And they're trying to find out how they've adapted to the present day America, which keeps riding away from them instead of towards them.
But Rhinebeck has also, Richard, become rather expensive compared to some of the other towns in the area. And that's because it has a great bridge. It has a train station.
Well, it also it's a beautiful little village. It's kept its historic character through the years for various reasons.
The audience and the characters share a time frame, but doing it the public, should we assume that they also share political attitudes?
Well, I mean, I think as Jay just said, I think it's not a question of an argument going forward. It's a question of asking questions about our country and the people who represent us, and even the people who we have supported. So I think the essence, as Jay said, is really the questioning, not the debate.
Marianne, how much does audience reaction affect the performance?
Well, I think we really live within our four walls. We relate to each other, and it doesn't feel like a play as we may have done other plays. You know, you can feel the warmth or you can feel the understanding, but it's not like, okay, here's a joke and we wait for the laugh. It's we're living within those four walls. So it's more about the warmth. They're part of it. They're looking in the window, but it's not cause and effect.
It's incredibly naturalistic as well. People talk over each other. Mm-hmm. That's all written into the script?
Yes, and it's directed that way. Richard directs the plays also, and one of his biggest things is he'll say, "No, that looks like a play. You know, what can we do to change that?"
So. This is almost literal kitchen sink drama, but very different from the British kitchen sink dramas, which were really about working class people who were struggling. These people are concerned about falling behind their neighbors, but it's not the same thing.
I think one thing, I avoid the use of the word naturalistic or realistic in terms of these plays. I go for something, another word, which is verisimilitude. Because we don't really have four walls, we don't have a set, we just have some chairs and a table and a stove and a sink and a refrigerator. So it's very very different than what you would think would be a naturalistic play. So we're after something not to recreate life, but to try to find some truths. I think that's where we're headed, and that's what we're trying to do.
Is it fair to say there's no real conflict in the play? Wouldn't that violate one of the basic rules of theater?
Well, I don't know who made those rules. I think this play, but many, many plays throughout history violate such rules. There are human beings. At the very essence of theater, in my mind, is a live human being speaking to other live human beings at the same time and in the same place. And given the world we live in right now, which is not often present, but lived through viscerally or through some other medium, that theater itself can have this rare and rich and very, very human experience.
We're talking about Hungary, not the country, Hungry, which is the first in a planned cycle of three plays entitled The Gabriels, Election Year and the Life of One Family. It's at the Public Theater until April 3rd, and with me are its playwright, Richard Nelson, and two of its stars, Marianne Plunkett and Jay O. Sanders. And Jay, your character, George, is the only man in this play.
I know. Well, I think there is a very special reason for that. The country is reflecting on what the face of women in this world is. That's a point in time we're at, and to see the face of so many women reflecting on that together and finding a sisterhood. I'm an important balance and maybe a bass note in this choir, but their voices are extraordinary, and to hear five women from five different places, five human beings, echo their differences is fascinating, really compelling.
Marion, your daughter doesn't show up for this ceremony. Is that an indication of a generational schism?
Well, I think it's also a personal. She's my daughter from a previous marriage, and as we will discover in later plays, there may be reasons she did not show up.
So. There have been a number of marriages in this family.
There have been. I've only had two.
Mm-hmm. But you and Jay are actually married.
Yes, we are.
I'm never sure whether that's a good thing for a married couple to
be. We can put that to rest. It is a good thing.
We love it.
It is an excellent thing. We're probably the greatest blessing in our lives is to be part of the Richard Nelson company and be able to work together on a daily basis on such profoundly beautiful plays.
Well, you had them in the Apple plays as well. So are you developing a company?
Well, I love the idea of company, and company is it's something that you have to experience to really understand. The idea of starting rehearsal on Hungary with Jay and Marianne having gone through the Apples and having them there who understood what I was trying to do and also could convey some of that in their own language as actors to the newer actors. It's an extraordinary experience.
Well, you Jay and Marianne have worked together with this cast for 4 years in the Apple cycle.
We did a tour to Europe last year. We did 4 years of putting them all together and then running them all together in the fourth year. And then the fifth year, we toured them to Europe and felt what they were like in different cultures, which was a whole other level of
and
magic.
And different responses to them?
Surprisingly the same, but clearly they had their own response. We had to have a glossary that explained who Andrew Cuomo was, mm-hmm. for example, and where what Reinbeck was. But those specifics became resonant in their own world where they had their own specifics.
On the other hand, I think Europeans know a lot more about American politics than
yes.
Americans know about European politics.
Right.
They may not know about Andrew Cuomo, but they know everything about all the people who are running for president mm-hmm. right
but
now.
We had an extraordinary circumstance there. We played in Brighton. We opened the Brighton Festival in England and played all four plays on one day, 2 days before their major elections, in which the Liberals were slated by polls to take everything. And 2 days later, they lost everything. And in talking with our friends and people who we met who had sat through with us through all four plays, their angst, listening to us talking about our specifics, but our progressive liberal politics, just musing on those issues and musing on the fear of what is going on now. And suddenly it was translated immediately after to their world. Extraordinary.
We once had the youngest member of the Leakey family, the famous Kenyan family, on our show, and she outraged a lot of listeners when she said, the whole world should be allowed to vote in U.S. presidential elections because they affect everybody. But I think foreigners understood that very well. Richard, when you started to write about the Gabriels, were you writing with the actors in the cast in mind?
Well, I only had, I knew that Jay and Marianne were going to be a part of this. And so, yes, I certainly wrote with them in mind, and both have been an inspiration to these plays. The other actors are all new to this process. Mm-hmm. So that, and that happened after the drafts were already written.
What happens to the Apples plays? Are you still going to be performing them?
Yeah,
aren't you taking them to Washington in 2017?
No, that's the Gabriels.
Oh, the Gabriels.
The Gabriels will play in marathons right through the inauguration at the Kennedy Center.
So there'll be history plays by then.
Well, absolutely, yeah.
Do the actors participate in developing any of this? Because I'm sure you know these characters so well.
Well, that would be, I think the question is really for Richard, because he gets what he gets from working with us, and we certainly talk about things, but ultimately choices are all Richard's. So I think we do participate by our presence, by our questions, by our observations, and by what we're able to bring to it. But
what's going on right now probably is a guarantee against writer's block.
Well, you know, it's what's going on in politics is one thing. What's going on with the family, this family, is another. And then trying to just create human beings and then have them somehow talk about what is happening is the dynamic that I'm after.
Now, during the whole play, a meal is being worked on. I would assume that's even a grounding thing for actors. Mm. But the play ends just as the meal has been completed. For the audience, this is really interesting because we smell everything
right.
that is being worked on. What happens to all that food? Do you eat it every night?
It goes various places.
It's distributed either the crew or we, or there are the entire theater, the public has, every space has a show in it right now. So sometimes it makes its way to other green rooms. And so it's distributed. It's always eaten.
Well, you wouldn't want to eat the same meal every night.
No.
But it looks pretty good.
Yeah, it is good.
It is good.
It's very good.
We don't have much time, Richard, but what's the difference between the Apples and the Gabriels?
Well, the Apple family didn't grow up in Rhinebeck. So those were a series of plays about people who moved one by one into this town. So they're finding a home. The Gabriels were people who were born there, and they're trying to deal with what it's become.
Hungry, the first of three planned plays in a cycle called The Gabriels, Election Year and the Life of One Family, is at the Public Theater, running until April 3rd. My great thanks to playwright Richard Nelson and actors Marianne Plunkett and J.O. Sanders for coming back to our show to talk about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a very topical theater, an elitist, out of touch Washington, D.C., a stolen election, a populist movement. The charismatic people's candidate is elected president, and a new era begins. Yes, we can. I mean, yes, they did, because the president portrayed in this play was our seventh. As they say in the show, he put the man in manifest destiny. I'm talking about Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, playing through May 9th at the Public Theater. Benjamin Walker, who plays Jackson, and Michael Friedman, who wrote the music and the lyrics for it, join me now. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having us.
Benjamin, is this play as exhausting to play in as it appears, or do you leave feeling exhilarated, adrenalated?
Well, I think we always say if the crowd is having half as much fun as we're having doing it, we've done our job. It's an exciting show. The music that Michael has written is a lot of fun to sing, and Alex's story is a lot of fun to tell, and we just go on the ride every night. I'd have to say it's a lot of fun. It's not exhausting at all.
Well, sometimes it's hard to tell if you're trying to make people laugh or make them think.
Well,
was that part of
that? We accomplished both.
I usually don't think when I'm laughing.
I think we hope that they'll actually the laughter will draw them in and then sort of surprise them that if they ever do start thinking beyond the laughter.
Weren't you a history and lit major at Harvard?
I was.
Has that background been useful to you in the theater?
Well, I joke that lately everything I work on seems to be based on some book that is sitting on my shelf that I did not read in college and that sits sort of like a reproach staring at me. So I actually took a class on Jacksonian America in school with a professor, William Gnapp, who's now dead. But so all the books from that actually sort of informed the writing of this show. So.
Well, how historically accurate is the play?
Sometimes.
I mean, like when we read the classic comics and then wrote a book report, could a high school student preparing for a history test be led astray by any of this?
There are a few places where things get conflated. There are a few places where we commit complete inaccuracy in the name of theater.
Like one of the characters eats Twinkies. I don't think they were invented.
Martin Van Buren, as far as we know, was not a major consumer of Twinkies. But he was
large. He was a large man. He would have eaten the equivalent of Twinkies at the time.
Were Jackson's family members killed by Indians?
That is not accurate at all. But the threat that his family felt from the British and the Spanish and the Native American populations, the sort of feeling, I think, of the Americans on the frontier of being constantly surrounded by hostile forces, which might have been imagined by them, but is, I think, still a feeling we as Americans have that we're constantly overwhelmed by that, and that, I think, was the feeling we wanted to get with his family.
And also to give some kind of a psychological reason behind what he did later.
That's possible, though I think a lot of his maneuvers are just him acting impulsively.
Benjamin Michael said he went back to his old books. Did you study up on Andrew Jackson?
I did. I read a wonderful book by Robert Remini. I read John Meacham's book. And I have a father who's a history buff, and he took us to the Hermitage when we were, my older brother and I were young boys. So I wasn't coming in blind. And we did a lot of work together dramaturgically, and I'm fascinated by American history, so it was a pleasure.
Although this play or this musical makes no attempt to look like what things would be, makes no pretense of being really set in 20?
Yeah.
There's as much Mick Jagger in your portrayal as there is Andrew Jackson.
Well, I hope so. Accurately, he was a rock star. That's more important in terms of the storytelling than whether or not we have his ruffles right.
You mean a rock star, the equivalent of a rock star?
Exactly. Thank you.
And Michael, was this play always envisioned as a rock opera?
Yeah, Alex and I were set up on kind of a professional blind date by a mutual friend, and by the end of about an hour, we'd come up with this idea that was basically Andrew Jackson and emo rock music somehow making a musical. So yeah, it was always conceived from the ground up that way.
And how would you define emo music?
Alex Timbers has a fantastic definition, which is it's sort of music that's it's so sincere that it's ridiculous and then becomes so ridiculous that it's actually kind of moving. But I like to think of it as a bunch of sort of moody boys in their 20s complaining about girls who wouldn't date them in high school, which is why the opening line of the opening song is just, "Why wouldn't you ever go out with me in school?"
Mm-hmm. I understand Elizabeth Suedos was a mentor to you. How did you meet her?
We met my senior year at Harvard, and then she asked me to work with her in New York on a bunch of projects, and so she was an early and a very important influence.
I have to ask both of you this. Why Andrew Jackson? Because you say he was the kind of rock star celebrity that we understand today but might not have at the time?
Well, I think when Alex and I started writing the show, it was under the Bush administration, W's administration. And at the time, I think the question of the uses and misuses of populism and the stealing of elections and those things were very much in the air. What's been really weird has been, as we've worked on the show, seeing it grow into being that Jackson is kind of, he's Bill Clinton, he's Jimmy Carter, he's certainly Ronald Reagan.
And then lately, Barack Obama.
He's Barack Obama and Sarah Palin and the Tea Party. So he covers... You know, he's the founder of the Democratic Party, but he covers a whole lot of ground in his influence.
He offered himself as an outsider, an anti-elitist.
And he was the first to do a lot of the things we take for granted. Like, he was the first to campaign as we traditionally think of it today. And that's another reason why he's significant.
Mm-hmm. You've been working on this for a long time, haven't you?
Almost 3 years, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Has it changed over time?
It has. We hope all in positive ways. We've trimmed a lot of the fat. We think it's funnier and faster ride for the audience. It's clearer. All positive changes.
Does the audience react differently when it's a matinee or when it's an 8 p.m. show? Because I have to tell you, I was surprised by just how young the audience was in a time when people are complaining about how theater audiences are pretty much aging.
It's been very gratifying to have such young audiences, and I think we have to say the public's done an amazing job at helping bring those audiences in for us. But yeah, it's been really fun. That said, I've been amazed by the consistency of this cast, and while sometimes there are particularly raucous audiences and sometimes more, you know, quiet ones, it's been amazing actually how consistent the audience response has been. We've been really happy with that, I think.
Well, there were a few times when I felt some of the younger audience members were laughing at inside jokes.
That might be true. There are certainly some references to some pop culture things that might not everyone in the audience might recognize.
Yeah, I wouldn't feel bad about missing jokes that are beneath you.
Well, let's talk about the marriage. Rachel mm-hmm. was Jackson's controversial wife. And did she really want him to quit politics?
She did, and she was plagued by the slander that they were receiving in the press as he progressed as a politician.
Even before the tabloids, they had the scandalous relationship because people claimed that she was a bigamist?
That's correct.
And it's not entirely inaccurate, that
right,
claim.
It's debatable whether or not they were knowingly or otherwise.
Actually, there was a movie I saw when I was a kid about that marriage, very sympathetic to her. The image you present of Jackson is a very complicated one. Somebody's even compared him to Hitler, although at the end you kind of suggested the jury is out. He was both a demagogue and also a man who brought a certain amount of more democracy to the country.
Well, certainly the historical record is still out in the sense that historians keep changing their tune about what they think Jackson is. In the last decade, you know, he's been called an American Hitler, but there's still some very hagiographic kind of books being written. So it goes both ways. People love him and they hate him. I don't think there's any other president who's quite so controversial among historians.
One of the songs says, it takes a celebrity of the first rank to make a good president. Washington was a celebrity.
Washington's the first great one. Though in that song, the idea is that part of the reason Washington, after two terms, said, I'm retiring to Mount Vernon, is he really couldn't take the pressure of what that kind of celebrity entailed, and that Jackson's trying to be the first one who really takes on what that populist zeal will be.
Is he an interesting character to play? Because, Benjamin, you've said that you're an actor who sings rather than a singer who acts.
He is an interesting character to play. And I think what's great about this piece is it's approached as a play with music as opposed to a musical. And he's interesting to play because he's, like we're discussing, quintessentially American. He's done horrible things, but at the same time, he's on the 20. And that's just a lot of fun for an actor to do, to have this wide berth of what he can be and who he was and who you can create him to be.
In terms of President Jackson and the Indian question, it's very seriously presented in the second half, but there's a fair amount of irreverent slapstick in the beginning.
I think we tried, it was a real rule going in the first half of the show to treat everyone with as much irreverence as possible. What I hope is that people begin to see that in a funny way, we're sort of seeing the world through Jackson's eyes, which is a really topsy-turvy world full of sort of cartoonish figures that he's kind of fighting against, so on all sides.
And also, at that time in America, when Washington's president, when Washington is president, we are in our infancy, and by the time Jackson rolls around, we're in our adolescence, which is a very zany, crazy, obnoxious time. And I think Michael and Alex have written a piece that embodies that in a way that it is adolescent and is fun and irreverent, and that comes through in the comedy.
I understand that the Trail of Tears pageant was changed from last year's laboratory production.
Yeah, in the very original workshop we'd done, partly because of the way the space worked and because we had 100 free apprentice performers who were able to do this, we had a kind of amazing tableau of the Trail of Tears going through the last scene, and it was very effective in that context. And we just realized last year that it had lost, it had become trite, which was the opposite of what we'd wanted to portray. So we made it just that final tableau, which I think allows, at least in the Newman Theater, at the Public, to be a more serious portrayal.
You've also been involved with The Civilians. What are The Civilians?
Civilians is a theater company. We do investigative theater, which means some kinds of documentary theater, but always theater based in explorations of real life, whether that's interviews or research, but always starting from that place.
Have any people complained about some of the things that are obviously politically very incorrect in this play?
Actually, I'm always amazed how much we're allowed to get away with so far.
I can see handicapped groups, Native American groups.
We've had some really interesting and I found really wonderful discussions, dialogues with actually both those groups, representatives from organizations or who have had really interesting things to say, sometimes critical, but never always interested in a dialogue. So it's actually been, for me, really eye-opening and interesting and helped us, I think, in rewriting the show.
Benjamin, I understand your future mother-in-law attended opening night.
It was nice of her to come.
Is she still okay about the marriage?
I sure hope so, but I'm afraid that's private.
Does she refrain from giving notes?
Yeah, she doesn't take mine either.
I understand that the show has been extended once. Is that likely to happen again?
We've extended 3 weeks and beyond our original closing, which is fantastic. And anything beyond that is up to the fates and out of our control. But we're having such a great run that, you know, we're happy with where we are right now.
Well, I want to thank the two of you so much for coming by to talk about it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Benjamin Walker, who plays Andrew Jackson in Bloody, Bloody Andrew Jackson, now at the Public Theater. And with Michael Friedman, who wrote the music and the lyrics and has written music for other shows, including The Seagull?
I've done two productions of The Seagull I've done a lot of Chekhov. If they'll pay me, I will write music for their show.
Mm-hmm. Well, Shakespeare loved music. I didn't know whether Chekhov ever included any songs in any of his shows.
There are a lot of fragments, actually. I mean, his shows are often constructed on little fragments of Russian songs, so he's really fun to work on as a composer because he's very savvy in his use of music.
It's been fun talking to both of you. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you.
We'll ruin the bank and we'll cripple the courts and we'll take on the world for America's sake and we'll take back the land and we'll take back the country. We'll take and we'll take and we'll take and we'll take. This country I'm making cannot be divided. The will of the people won't stand in my way.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Frank Langella has a way of inhabiting a role so completely that you can watch an entire performance and not recognize it's him until the curtain call. His latest onstage incarnation is as Richard M. Nixon in the hit play Frost Nixon, a behind-the-scenes story of David Frost's legendary interviews with the former president 30 years ago. And I'm delighted it has given me the opportunity to speak once again with the wonderful Frank Langella. Welcome back.
Hello, Leonard. Nice to be back.
Did you pay a lot of attention to politics during the Nixon years?
No. I was in my late 20s, I guess, and an actor in working all over the country in summer theaters, and you know what you're paying attention to when you're that age. It's certainly not politics.
Well, actually, it was the 30s. I mean, you were in your 30s because it was the 70s.
You're right. I was in my 30s.
But you were still not paying attention. Were you aware of the Watergate hearings?
Oh, sure,
did you watch the resignation speech?
They were as riveting then as O.J. was now.
Yeah. When you were sent the script, did you know immediately this was the part you wanted to play?
No, I didn't. I I was actually a little afraid of it when I first read it, not necessarily for the character, but for the actual script itself, which was just words on a page. And I had a feeling it might be a rather dry evening of my standing up and then my sitting down and my walking across the stage and maybe drinking a glass of water. I wasn't prepared for the exciting thriller aspect that the director, Michael Grandage, brought to it.
And that's the way he has described it. It's also, I guess, a chess game. And I don't know if that's the same thing as a thriller, but it works that way.
Yeah.
We see the two sides working out strategies, and
yeah.
and then we see how the game finally transpires.
It's also much more of a psychological thriller than I anticipated it would be. I am able to find a way into the heart of Nixon as a man, as a human being, as a flawed person than I thought I would be able to when I first read it.
You don't bear much of a physical resemblance to Richard Nixon. Was there a temptation to put on a prosthetic nose or to use special makeup to approximate his pasty skin tone?
No, actually, there wasn't even a thought in my head about trying to look like him. As a matter of fact, I plead guilty to the fact that I didn't want to look anything like him in the beginning, and I resisted even a wig. Mm. And then, of course, Michael convinced me that I owed it somehow visually to the audience to appear somewhat like him, if not exactly. But noses and chins and jowls never came up at all.
Well, another reason for wearing the wig, or at least looking a bit like him, is that another character in the play is the huge television screen. Mm-hmm. And we can't help but watch your face when you're on television, watch your face on the screen and then you on the stage, the real you, and go back and forth, because that's part of what this play is also about
yeah.
reality and what television does to reality.
Yeah. It's so much an extraordinarily apt story about how television, as the play says, simplifies and reduces everything to a second, to a beat. And Nixon was probably the first great tragedy of that medium in terms of our deciding about somebody in a split second. And now, of course, we do it all the time about absolutely everybody.
And that's because the reason given for his losing to JFK, although there may have been other reasons, was that he looked so terrible in the first televised debates.
Yeah, and he doesn't, really. If you look at them again, JFK looks better. And, you know, the story...
Well, he was a handsome man.
He was, but the story is that people who listened to it on the radio believed that Nixon won. But people who saw it were affected by JFK's good looks and Nixon's sweaty upper lip and his not incredibly handsome face.
Didn't you originate this role in the London production at
yeah.
the Dunmar?
Yes.
Are the British as familiar with this story as Americans are?
No, not as much. Certainly the interest there, all the pre-interest in the play was in the character of David Frost, because David is there, he lives in England, he's been a fixture there for 45 or I guess going on 50 years now. And when we came here, it switched because this country, of course, is so familiar with Richard Nixon.
So people there are more attuned to the nuances of Michael Sheen's portrayal of David Frost.
They were very attuned to the sound of him the moment Michael comes on in
which
London.
Which he does brilliantly.
Yeah, absolutely. The minute he appeared in London, of course, there were great gales of laughter when he opened his mouth. And here, Nixon's appearance gets a rumble from people, and then I spend the first 5 or 10 minutes of the play making sure the audience understands this isn't going to be a caricature and it isn't going to be something to laugh at unnecessarily or inappropriately. Eventually you find out that Nixon is funny as well.
Because he was a witty man in his own way.
Yeah.
But that's what happened with me, I think, for the first 3 or 4 minutes. It was...
The visual.
I had to adjust, and then you became Richard Nixon. I didn't think twice about it from then on. In the case of Michael Sheen, he's making a kind of a career of this because he was Tony Blair in The Queen, and I was wondering whether he has to resign now because Blair is going.
I'm sure that Peter Morgan is going to write that part of Blair's life. And there'll be a trilogy, and Michael will finish out the trilogy.
So since American audiences responded differently than the British audiences, has that changed the feeling of the play to some degree? Because because the audience is always another character in every play.
Well, for me, always in everything I do, the audience is the last piece of the puzzle. I've never understood actors who say, I act for myself. I'm up there for my own sake. I'm up there for the audience's sake. And I want them to have a stirring, emotional, fascinating, angering, sad, funny, whatever I can stir in an audience, I'm willing to stir. And in this particular play, and because Nixon is such a familiar character, and because we try very much to bring full dimension to him so that he isn't just a crook and he isn't just a drunk, but he's a lonely, isolated, terribly paranoid, frightened, angry, full of bile person.
But I also think, very smart, very clever, wily.
And all the other things, too. His brain is so fervid and furtive, both things at the same time, that I think the audience is wrapped up in him in ways we didn't have in London. And what's really remarkable is the quality of the silence in the last 20 minutes. There's this wonderful phone call that Nixon makes late at night, drunk. And from that
this
moment
is totally imagined.
Yeah, totally imagined.
But really very revealing.
Very apt, I think, in which he basically explains to Frost that they are the same kind of person, each at the bottom of the ladder, each trying very hard to get back up to the top. And from that moment on, the stakes are now so high that the quality of the silence in the audience from then until the curtain is really thrilling.
My guest is Frank Langella, who stars as Richard M. Nixon in Frost Nixon, which is at the Bernard B. Jacobs Theater at 242 West 45th Street. Is this a limited run, or is this going to go for a while?
No, it's limited. We go until August the 19th, and we begin the film August the 27th, very short break.
David Frost once said that it was impossible to really know the former president. Well, you had to try to figure it out, didn't you?
Yes.
Do you think that he was right? Obviously, it's impossible for me to know Frank Langella from just the conversations we've had on the air.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, because I was talking to someone 2 days ago about someone who had been treating me very badly at one point and who behaved in sort of childish, foolish way. And I was describing how angry I was and hurt by this person. And after I finished getting it all off my chest, this person said to me, well, I've always had found him to be nothing but sweet and kind and thoughtful and charming, the total opposite of my experience. And I was reminded again never to judge anybody by what anybody else says about them or even what you see on the screen of them, but to only judge them, if that's the word, by how they treat you, one-to-one. Had I been in a room with Richard Nixon, I probably would have found him keenly intelligent and probably charming, because it's the job of presidents to be charming to visiting guests. That would be different than if I'd worked with him. I'd have another experience.
We have a clip of David Frost asking Richard Nixon about Kissinger's personality. Mm. And that's kind of interesting, because there's a lot of psychology going on. Maybe we should listen to it.
And after you do, I'll tell you what Henry told me about Nixon.
You must have had disagreements, I suppose. What were the most important ones? I'm a fatalist, basically. Kissinger is more, despite his enormous intellectual capability, is one who is perhaps somewhat less fatalistic and or determinist in his views. More emotional, interestingly enough. Although I, too, have emotions. I tend to hide them, perhaps, more than he does, or to submerge them or suppress them. But be that as it may, we won't try to psychoanalyze each other at the moment.
Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger. And so revealing, don't you think, even though he called himself guarded?
It's also revealing in how much of a politician is he. He says, although I have emotions, but I really don't. I show them, but I really don't. Henry's this, but he's really that. He just covers all of his bases, and that was a trait I really discovered in studying him. You know?
And you spoke to a lot of people to gain insight into him,
endless
including
amount.
Kissinger?
Including Henry. Henry was the least amount of time I spent because we just happened by great fortune to be dinner companions one night at a dinner party, a very small one. So he was to my left and I was able to. And this was after the play had opened in London, and he asked me about it and asked me, how am I portrayed in the play? And I said, well, you're not in it as a character, but you are. And he asked me how I came to feel about Nixon. And I told him I had developed enormous compassion for him. And first of all, when you're playing a part, you cannot judge the person you're playing. You must love them. And I do. He's my guy. And Henry said, I felt that way too in the later years. And in my reflections, I came to feel affection for him and great respect for the brain. And if I needed a lawyer, Dick Nixon would have been the man I would have chosen.
Although Nixon also talks about Kissinger lapping up celebrity,
yeah,
and in those Frost interviews, and sometimes being indiscreet and making fun of him, but he understood because that was part of being a celebrity.
I think they recognized in each other, as actors do, the monster side. You know, great monsters recognize other great monsters. And the funniest thing that Henry ever said was, I think it was Barbara Walters who asked him, what is it like now that you're famous and now that you're Secretary of State? And he said, it's wonderful now, because now when I bore people, they think it's their fault.
Mm-hmm. You spoke to others who had been close to Nixon. Did they all find him interesting?
Everyone.
And they all felt compassion for him?
I don't know. I spoke to Frank Gannon for a very long time, who worked with the president.
He's a historian.
Yes, and Barbara Walters, who interviewed him, sent me all of the tapes. Mike Wallace gave me all of the stuff he had. But again, people like Barbara and Mike will get their impressions based on interviewing him. They will not have spent an evening with him. They will not have gotten to know him at home. They're certainly not going to feel about him the way his daughters do or his colleagues do. Frank Gannon was, I think, one of my richest sources because he spent so much time with Nixon, and I asked him to describe Nixon just as a man, not as a politician. What was his impressions of him walking into a room, sitting in a chair? How did he behave that way? And he did. He very openly described the human being to me. And I think probably the most telling research, that's the word telling, was going to his house where he was born and sitting in the little tiny house in Yorba Linda in his bedroom, which was smaller than this studio, with a peaked roof so that I couldn't stand up in it straight. Two single beds, four boys grew up there, two died. His parents' bedroom was not much larger than a large walk-in closet with a double bed in it. And all the simple artifacts around, the bucket for the water and the tiny little sink and kitchen and the few dishes. A man grew up in that kind of simple Sears house. They bought it from Sears and became president and married his childhood sweetheart.
You do a lot of research. There are actors who've told me I just read the text and find the character in the text. But you seem to go all the way. I wonder what happened when you were doing Dracula. I fear for your friends' necks.
Yes, it's true. There are 30 years ago, there were women, many, many women all over the country with two puncture wounds in
there. Some of them probably were offering the necks.
Best research I ever did. But I actually don't, because funnily enough, I really believe fact and reality stifles your imagination. But in this instance, in this character and in this man, I felt a tremendous obligation to do all of that. So once I let it all go, and once I took off in a flight of fancy, because it is, after all, part fiction, this play, and it is an evocation of someone, it is not a historical document, I wanted to have a rooted ground feeling about him. I wanted to have certain senses of him, and then I let it all go and let my imagination take over.
So you got a sense of who he really was rather than worried about whether you were making the V for victory sign or yeah. doing any of the other things that people that Herblock might have noticed when he was doing a political cartoon.
And I also don't care much in this particular instance because we're doing a play about the political elements or the facts of what actually happened. I care about bringing a human being to the stage that people will have some form of some strong reaction to in all ways.
My guest is Frank Langella, who, along with Michael Sheen, Stephen Kunkin, Corey Johnson, Shira Gregory, I'm going to leave out some of the people, but I have to mention Stephen Rowe, who does the most amazing Swifty Lazar.
Yes, he does.
They're all performing in Frost Nixon, now at the Bernard B. Jacobs Theater on West 45th Street. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. And we're back with Frank Langella, who is starring as Richard Nixon in Frost Nixon at the Bernard B. Jacobs Theater at 242 West 45th Street. You've played a fair number of men of power, powerful men. We saw you as William Paley in a wonderful recent film, Good Night and Good Luck. We've seen you Nixon, Dracula. There have been others as well. Do they all have something in common? Perry White in Superman Returns.
In terms of my career, I suppose I've noticed that a number of times that I tend to be attracted to playing singular men, sometimes mysterious loners. When I look back at all the roles I played, many, many of them have been that. William Paley, the man in Dave, Bob Alexander, and certainly Richard Nixon and Dracula and a couple of parts I played on Broadway.
Is that because people see you in those roles and offer you those parts?
I think it's twofold. I think they see me in those roles, but also I think my tendency to want to play those men is because they're full of either immortal yearnings or huge, giant issues to do with failure, to do with somehow overcoming and somehow having supernatural powers. I'm attracted to characters. I was very attracted to a character like Dracula and to Nixon because they're terribly flawed and they're much more interesting to play than the average Joe.
But those others were extroverts. And Richard Nixon is the only extrovert introvert who ever became president of the United States.
And he is, in fact, very much the opposite of me in manner, demeanor. And, you know, I am rather extroverted. I'm Mediterranean. I'm Italian. So finding those qualities, which are, of course, all inside me, and using them in an outward way was fascinating for me.
Because but I think part of the fun of acting must be just becoming somebody else and understanding who that person is, at least for that certain period that you're on the stage.
It's actually not a great role if you don't learn something profound from it. And I'm learning more and more about myself every day when I play Richard Nixon. All the great parts are parts that test you and your own sense of yourself, because we all walk around with these ridiculous, foolish notions of what and who we are. And when you're an actor and you're able to delve into someone else's psyche, you really do find that you're playing mostly your own, or your own take on it, so that you're calling upon the things in yourself. I had to reach down and find the very worst of my nature, all my paranoia, all my suspicion, all my competitiveness, all my anger, all my desire to do in my enemies. And Nixon is the poster boy for that.
So does this function as a kind of psychoanalysis? After the fact, you're just going to be one of the most wonderful people anybody could ever know?
No, I'll never be that. It's too late. But you can take it too far in terms of psychoanalysis. Once the play is over, the character stays where he belongs. But it is still a blessing, really, and a privilege to be an actor, because you can explore all of these things in a creative, artistic way. You can act in spite of your neurosis, not because of it.
You mentioned earlier Peter Morgan. This is his first play, but he's written quite a few screenplays, and two of his most recent ones were huge successes. The Last King of Scotland, in which Forrest Whitaker plays the flawed, crazy guy, and The Queen, in which any number of people are flawed in different ways. So he obviously likes this sort of story.
Yeah, I think Peter's very drawn, equally drawn to power, powerful figures, and conflict.
Part of the build-up to the TV shows that the play is about involves how both camps hope to make the most of the interviews. Frost and Nixon had an awful lot to lose in the process. How well known was David Frost in the United States at the time? And well, why do you think that Nixon was willing to be interviewed by him and not anyone else?
He started out in a show called That Was the Week That Was, and I remember him as a very young man.
That was a kind of comedy show that commented on the news.
And then he, you know, David is, if nothing else, a man who survives and a man who keeps going on in all sorts of ways. I think Nixon and his people looked upon David as, a softball, an easy, easy interview for which he would be paid a great deal of money and a lightweight interviewer who would not get him on the important issues.
They saw him more as an entertainer than as a news junkie. Yeah. But he did something that was quite smart. He hired people who did know, and he went into training. Both Nixon and Frost went into training for this. It was almost like a heavyweight bout.
And I think it should be said, importantly, and I don't think it's said enough, how much James Reston plays in this. Jimmy Reston is the inspiration for this play, his book. About Nixon, which I think is coming out again, is fascinating and wonderful. And James Reston had a great deal to do with uncovering the material that enabled David to finally trap Nixon.
And that he is a major character in the play as well.
He's the narrator of the play.
We mentioned earlier that it was kind of a thriller, and I said it was also like a chess game. The director, Michael Grandage, said it's a thriller. Does a British director bring something to this that an American might not have because he has perspective?
I don't know. I don't, talent is talent. Doesn't matter if you're British or American. Certainly Michael did his homework and was aware of what the historical elements are. But a less gifted director might not have brought out the thriller aspects, the mise-en-scène, the use of cameras, music, and the visual, and Christopher Oram, who did the sets and the costumes, who's Michael's partner. They work beautifully together and create the whole arena in which Michael and I are able to perform these characters. I don't think it matters much whether they're British or American. Talent doesn't know about that.
In your research, did you learn much about how Nixon trained?
Yes. Oh, one of the greatest days of my life was sitting at Richard Nixon's desk at the library and having his staff bring me in his personal notes that he was making in preparation for the interviews. And there would be large packets of things from Gannon and Diane Sawyer and other people.
She was working for him at the time?
She was working for him. He called her the tall girl. He didn't know her. He didn't know her name for a year. He called her the tall girl. And these notes would say, Mr. President, we think Mr. Frost might ask this particular question. We suggest this particular answer. And Nixon memorized those things.
Do you think that there was something of an actor about Richard Nixon? As an actor, do you see an actor in him?
Look, they're all actors. Every single one of them is an actor. What this has taught me more than anything else is that a second before you point to someone on the radio, they assume a piece of personality that they want you to see and they want the audience to hear. And just a beat before any politician walks out in front of a camera, he unconsciously or consciously makes a decision to present something. If you look at that wonderful tape of Mr. Edwards, whom I admire, getting his hair in order, it's wonderful. Who of us doesn't do that? It isn't something he would prefer, I'm sure, that nobody saw. But I've been around so many people in the wings in functions, and I've watched them change their personality within a split second. I've watched standing in the dark, hearing their name said, and I've watched a whole physical thing change, because that's what public life is.
Well, we all present a persona.
And we present
and
it privately
and
as
sometimes,
well.
And sometimes we're better at presenting a good persona than others.
You know the maxim about show business, the thing you have to be to succeed in show business is sincere. And once you learn to fake that, you're in.
At what point in your research were you willing to watch the actual Frost-Nixon interviews?
Oh, from the start. It was one of the first major thing I did was spend 10 hours at the Museum of Radio and Television, and a lovely woman there brought me, I don't know, must have been 100 tapes. And I just got a big bottle of orange juice, and I just kept putting the tapes in. I put my feet up. It was the very first day of research, well over a year ago, and I was overwhelmed by it. I couldn't stop scribbling on a yellow legal pad. He does this with his hands. He's always mm-hmm. that with his mouth. He's always licking his lips. I mean, there was so much. To absorb and so much to play and then a lot to dismiss.
But it's interesting watching them now. I think we read all sorts of things into his answers that we wouldn't have known then because we have a fuller picture of what really happened.
Yeah. It's no secret that he brought himself down. He could have avoided this in a second. All he would have had to have done immediately was say these people made a terrible, heinous mistake. And I'm flushing them all out and getting rid of them, and I will pay whatever fines are necessary, and life would have gone on. It's the cover-up that killed him, really, more than anything else.
We talked earlier about how audiences in England responded differently to audiences in this country. What about the people who knew Nixon? Have they come up to you and talked about what they saw in the play?
Tricia Cox's entire family came, her husband and children and various relatives, and they were very kind to me about it and very, very thankful that I tried to give them a dimensional man and not just a drunken crook. And lots of people.
But it would have been an ineffective play if you'd done that.
It would have been a bore to play as well, and it would have been a cliche. And then people on his staff have come back, a lovely woman who worked for him, whom he gave an ambassadorship to, and many people have come back and said, I don't know how you know this about him, but... and told me something that was reflected from my performance. It was just pure instinct on my part. I had no fact about it. He ultimately affected people. He's one of those people who you cannot be about. You know, you either are terribly, terribly passionate about him in fury and rage or deeply, deeply moved by his vulnerability, his pain, his awkwardness, his sweaty hands, is looking down at his feet all the time, all those things. I think in a way, I don't think I've ever quite thought of it this way before, that he's a walking example of the worst in all of us, you know? Oh, God, I don't want anybody to see how unattractive I feel. I want that girl across the room to really like me, and I'm going to put my foot in my mouth. And it was just there all over him. You couldn't miss it.
It's interesting that when you're approaching a role that was totally invented, you can come up with all those things. You can look down at your shoes because you think that that would be more effective. In this case, you have somebody who's already given you a lot of that. So I suspect that your problem is deciding what to leave out rather than what to put in.
Well, actually, I would say it in a different way, which is at a certain point, once I'd absorbed what I felt was the verisimilitude of it, if that's the word, the real truth of him, so I wasn't going to, you know, suddenly give him curly hair or walk with a limp or something. All those things, of course, would be ridiculous. But once the reality of him got deeply inside me, I forgot that, and then I let myself explore in anybody I play what I believe are the most human characteristics. And clearly those things must exist in me or I couldn't play them. This is true of every character I play that I draw on myself.
All actors do, don't they? Well, all good actors?
Some actors don't, actually. Some actors, I think, say, my character would. I never use those words. I think this character would. The character is you, no matter who you're playing. From the time I was a very young actor to now, I sort of know that it's got to be pieces of me.
Haven't you also signed to do the screen version of the play?
Yes.
With Ron Howard directing?
Yes, I have.
Now, I'm assuming that things will change. You've done other things on the stage and then the movie version, Dracula, for example.
Only that.
With Laurence Olivier.
I know, but I'm an extraordinarily lucky actor that I've actually created two roles on stage that I'm getting to do the film of. That so rarely happens.
Because usually you wind up doing the Broadway thing and you assume they're going to sign you, and then they sign somebody who they think is bankable.
Exactly. Let's hope they think I'm bankable.
Well, I can't imagine who they would have signed for this after what you've done on the stage. But have you seen the film script?
No, not yet. I will be seeing it shortly. That said, George Hamilton came to see the play the other day, and we were talking about the fact that he very much wanted to play Dracula after I left the show, and the producers weren't interested.
Oh, so he would have been fabulous.
Well, he went and wrote his own script called Love at First Bite, and it was a huge success, and it came out before us, and it killed our film because he spoofed it, and it was wonderful, and very, very clever of him.
Do you see yourself as more of a theater animal than a movie person?
No, I.
Because for a while it looks like you dropped out of films. I don't know whether it's their choice or your choice.
No, it's,
but you've been doing a lot of theater.
It's, you know, I get I talk about people behaving in disingenuous ways. Whenever I hear an actor say, "Oh, I decided to move away from pictures for a while," I laugh. You don't move away from pictures; they move away from you. And when they move away from you, I am fortunate enough to have a theater career. I've always worked on the stage. And certain years I find myself with an incredible amount of riches. As now, I have a beautiful film I made called Starting Out in the Evening, which was a great success at Sundance, which is opening across the country in November. And I'm about to start shooting another wonderful film while I'm doing this, and Frost Nixon. So I have three films, but there have been 5-6 year periods where I certainly didn't move away from the movies. They moved away from me, but there's so much else I'm able to do that I'm lucky.
You've already won 2 Tonys, and you've been nominated for this one. Do you have enough space on the mantle to accommodate all of those statues?
If I don't, I'll build a bigger mantle.
Because that is the ultimate, even though we say that those awards don't matter all that much, especially when we think somebody else is going to win it, when we get those accolades, it really does feel great, doesn't it?
The ultimate is the performance, really, and all the accolades and the awards are the small little visual representations of it. But and again, I'm not being disingenuous at all, I think awards are wonderful thank yous, and I enjoy getting them. But really, the performance is what lives inside you all the time, and you have those few marvelous moments when you hear your name called. But as I said the last time I won a Tony, I know the moments will be over quite quickly, and someone else will be getting one. But the performance goes on with you, stays with you.
Are there any roles that you played that you have particular fondness for, or are they all your children?
I have been, again, I'm a very fortunate actor. I've always managed to do what I wanted to do, particularly in the theater. And I have a whole wheelbarrow full of great parts that I remember, like The Father, the Strindberg play, and Bob Alexander in Dave, and Claire Quilty in Lolita, and Dracula, and my first role, a lizard, in my Broadway debut. I have had a wonderful, wonderful army of people I've been able to explore.
So you began with Albee. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, my first job.
And now Frost Nixon. It's being performed at the Bernard B. Jacobs Theater, 242 West 45th Street. If you want to buy tickets, the number there is 212-239-6200. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Leonard. I'll come back anytime you have me.
Oh, thank you.
Bye.